Hi, guys, and welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. This is Andreas Steno from Real Vision speaking. Turkey is stuffed, and it is not even Thanksgiving yet. This is, of course, a Thanksgiving joke, but it's also very telling for the financial landscape that we are amidst. We will get back to why, but Turkey is actually the best performer in the world when it comes to equity markets this year. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Weston Nakamura from Tokyo. It's very good to see you, Weston. I'm looking forward to spending the next 30 minutes in your company.
Yes, sir. Good to see you, too.
We will try to make it an interactive session today. So we strongly urge you to ask all the questions you may have. We will answer as many as possible over the next 30 minutes. So shoot us your questions at YouTube, Twitter, the Real Vision webpage, and so on. We will get back to those in a second. But before we get to the questions, Weston, we had the Fed minutes earlier, and I think the headlines were pretty clear, right? It is now written on paper that Fed officials see smaller rate hikes coming soon. What do you make of that in the market reaction?
As far as like Fed funds pricing, I mean, now we're at 50 basis points with an 80% chance. That wasn't really, it's already been there. So it's, I think that's kind of not really changing any of that narrative. But markets were kind of not rallying per se, but we're seeing some upside prior to that. And that was coming off of the PMI from November manufacturing that slipped below estimates as well. So there's sort of this kind of upside in equity markets already underway before that happened. And mind you, this is also the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. You have very light volumes. You had very light volumes in Europe as well. So it's a lot of systematic flows.
Yeah, indeed. And it's always interesting to watch the price action on a day like this just ahead of Thanksgiving, because, I mean, the usual narrative is that the market trading is sort of thin liquidity-wise, and therefore we see these moves around key figures to a larger extent than usual, maybe. So on days like this, do you watch out or do you just lean back, Weston?
No, days like this are very, very interesting, and very, not just interesting, but they're actually really critical to watch because of what I was just saying before about like systematic flows and stuff like that. Like, so if the active fund management community, human traders, if you will, are largely absent from market participation on days like this, especially the US-based ones, right? We get to see the picture of what the market trades like absent those players. And when you have something like a, you know, weaker than expected PMI print come through, and you see what the market reaction is, the, you know, bad news is good news or whatever, you know, you could assume that, well, if they're absent, if the market is absent those active managers and those active participants, then the systematics are apparently currently programmed for trading markets directionally in terms of bad news equals good news. And so we have to keep that in mind for when the next time we sort of see them too, because, you know, active managers, they don't make like split second decisions once a single sort of data point or whatever comes out, be it a jobs number, a CPI, whatever it is. A lot of it is just systematic flows and futures driven and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to see in isolation. And these are those sort of times where we get to see that.
We have a question on YouTube that I will simply like to pass on to you, Weston. It's from Mike asking you, with the reported shortage of turkeys in the US, how do you plan to play the trade ahead of Thanksgiving? Are you long or short, or do you plan to lean back and wait for dessert?
I have no trading advice on turkeys.
Me neither. It tends to be a dry trade, at least. Let me put it like that. So, in any case, I wanted to show a chart that I find almost mind-blowing, and I've borrowed it from my friend Charlie Bilello. So I hope you can bring it up on the screens, Brian. It's basically a heat map of the developments across the country ETFs measured in US dollars, so country ETFs on equities, across the board, across the globe, basically. And the reason why I made this joke about Turkey earlier this year is that Turkey is the extreme outlier this year when you look at equity returns. Measured a couple of days ago, it was up 67.2% in US dollars, that equity ETF on the Turkish market. Pretty interesting given what's going on in Turkey with bizarre double-digit inflation, a central bank not willing to fight it. But apparently, the valuations of the Turkish stock market were so low that from a value perspective, it made sense to buy into it. And if you look at this, let's say top 10 list on the ETF heat map here, we have countries like Chile, Brazil, Mexico, Qatar, the World Cup host, Peru, Argentina. I mean, all kind of in the emerging markets bucket, while if you look at the blue covered area, we have the US right in the middle of the pack with roughly a 15% drawdown this year, Japan at minus 18% Western. Quite an interesting picture. And I mean, if you asked someone 1st of Jan whether this would be the picture come the end of the year, no one would have dared to answer this. I would be quite explicit about that. So what do you make of this picture? Is it something that you've noted and is something that you've sort of pondered whether to sort of expect to continue into next year?
You mean regarding specifically like TUR Turkey?
But I mean just the difference between developed markets and emerging markets in this sense.
Yeah, I mean, so this is kind of what I've talked to you about kind of internally, as well as, you know, I actually just talked about this on a, I was on a podcast, the What the Finance podcast that's just came out on YouTube earlier today. It's on my Twitter as well. And I dive into sort of this thesis of 2023, in which I think that we're entering, or we have already entered, this kind of period of market fragmentation, where you're going to start seeing, like, it's not going to be this kind of blanket risk on, risk off, or strong dollar, all EMs down equally, or everything, you know, all DM currencies moving in tandem, percent against the dollar or what have you. You're going to see kind of dispersion, because you're going to get the central bank veil lifted away. That was a time where a lot of things were papered over, and then it's going to expose a lot of the idiosyncrasies within and among regions, countries, companies, sectors. And so you'll probably start to see some more, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's going to be fundamentally, you know, aligned, but dispersions amongst all that. Another thing too, I'll say about Japan, the Japan ETF, that, yeah, I guess it's taken a beating. But if you look at DXJ, which is like the Japan, the currency hedge one, ETF, that one's up, I think it's like probably around 10% year to date. And it hasn't really been, it's been kind of flat the entire year. And that's obviously because of the currency hedge. So, yeah.
Yeah, so the reason for the underperformance is basically the dollar yen moving upwards throughout the course of 2022. We have a question from Fred coming in on YouTube, asking us about the current state of the Turkish economy. And I'm happy to at least give my perspectives, and please chip in, Weston, if you have anything to add on Turkey. But we published a piece on Turkey earlier today called The Rise of the Turks, obviously seen in perspective of this outperformance in Turkish equities this year. But I actually think that Turkey is one of the few countries gaining from this conflict in Ukraine. The first reason is that some of the southern European economies, they use Turkish soil to sort of circumvent the sanctions against Russia. We've seen a material pickup in exports from Italy to Turkey, and at the same time, a surprise pickup in exports from Turkey to Russia. So I think some of these southern European economies, they use Turkish soil to basically redistribute goods that they used to sell to the Russian economy. So that's one thing that is of essence to the Turkish economy in this scenario. And then secondly, it seems as if the whole Turkish region, and here I include countries like Azerbaijan, they stand to gain from the lack of natural gas coming from Russia to Europe, because the pipeline towards that region is still intact from Russia to Turkey and onwards, but also the pipeline being built from Azerbaijan to Europe with natural gas, a big deal being signed, is on the cards now. So that whole region, weirdly enough, actually gains a bit from this Ukraine conflict, and I think you should see the outperformance of Turkish equities in that perspective. And I also want to add that I think 4 or 5 months ago, I tweeted a chart on price earnings valuations across countries. And I think at the time, the average Turkish equity traded at in between 3 and 3.5 for the PE multiple, which is extremely low in an international setting. So you actually get your money back, if you look at it that way, pretty swiftly in Turkey. So the cash flow is there relative to the valuation. And I think that's been of essence this year. Cash flows are king in a scenario like the current. Anything you want to add on that relative pricing globally and PEs and cash flow considerations, Weston?
Well, you certainly made a good fundamental case that I was unaware of. I will, however, say that, well, let's see, this time last year, Turkey was in the middle of an extreme currency crisis, still is for that matter. Last year, headline inflation in Turkey was around 20%. Now it's north of 80% and climbing. And at the same time, the CBRT, the central bank, has been cutting rates and doing basically the exact opposite of what conventional economics would say, which is that you should probably be hiking rates. But oddly enough, the lira is kind of just been stuck at these levels of what we saw last year, around like, you know, in the 18 handle. And this is like a very, you know, I guess you could say intervened currency, because just to bring it back to last year you saw the USDTRY basically move from like around 9 or 10 up to 18 within the course of a few weeks, until President Erdogan came out of nowhere, announced this kind of new program, and essentially the central bank also used reserves and smashed USDTRY down 50% within the course of like 30 hours or so. Extreme volatility. Realized vol was higher on the lira than it was on Bitcoin at the time. So, I mean, yeah, like I just can't really like trust that particular market because of a lot of these very, very weird, like, I wouldn't even call them shenanigans, but like, you know, idiosyncratic to Turkey sort of things that are happening. And I think that like a lot of the inflows and the upside that you're seeing on the index, at least, is certainly has to be from at least in part domestics that are rushing in just as an inflation hedge, or just to buy anything that is not, you know, just holding lira.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Absolutely fair point. And let me just add before I pop the champagne on behalf of Turkey that being a sell-side strategist for more than 10 years on European soil, I can guarantee you that being long Turkey has been the widowmaker in Europe. So, I wouldn't pop the champagne too early on that story, but certainly there are some things sort of brewing beneath the surface, helping the Turkish economy in a very, very difficult situation. And you should remember this is a pickup in equity prices from an extreme low. Some of the key stocks at the Turkish exchange traded at in between 1 and 1.5 in PE multiples. So, I mean, you basically get your money back in 1 year. Quite the difference from another company that we want to talk about right now, Apple. I don't recall the exact PE that it's trading at, but probably 30, 40, 50 times as much as the Turkish equity market. And we have an interesting story from China. We don't have boots on the ground right now there, but we've seen this story of clashes with the police outside of the Foxconn factory in the southern part of China. So the Apple iPhone manufacturing side. And I mean, we have a question whether this has something to do with Apple or whether this is something related to the zero COVID policy in China. Any views on that and the story that unfolded earlier today, Weston?
Yeah, that one is kind of puzzling to me because so what we're hearing is, you're exactly right, you're hearing kind of two stories. Like, why are these protests and why are these clashes with the police happening in this particular instance? And you're getting kind of two stories. You're getting one is a COVID-related one, and the other one is that the company is not fulfilling their like salary or the payments. They're not paying their workers, essentially, is another story that you're getting. So I don't know which one it necessarily is. What I find strange, however, is that, so this is all over media right now, right? This particular protest. But these are certainly not the only protests that have been going on. There's a lot of protests happening all over China for various reasons, mostly which are like anti-COVID zero protesting. But those get scrubbed off of like Chinese social media pretty quickly and don't really make it out into sort of broad-based Western media. This, however, is seemingly allowed. And I find it coincidental or strange, at the very least, that this is a Foxconn is a Taiwanese company supplying to a major US company, Apple, that they're allowing for this to kind of leak out there. So you can make of that what you will, but you know, it's something to mention.
I wanted to add that I've spent quite a few hours over the past week assessing whether this Chinese reopening story has got legs or not. And my brief take on it is basically that if you look at restrictions in big cities, they're actually moving in the opposite direction of this reopening story. So restrictions in Beijing, restrictions in Shanghai, and restrictions in Guangzhou, they are moving in the wrong direction. And for the first time since the pandemic started, we have sort of firmer restrictions on average in these three cities than the overall national average. And I think that's quite interesting to follow on a daily basis, given that this reopening story sort of made the rounds in global media over the past couple of weeks. So if you ask me right now, this reopening story is basically dead if you look at the actual action on ground in China, at least in the big cities. And the big question is what happens in both the southern part of China, where these riots with the police happened at the Foxconn factory earlier today, but also in Shanghai due to the importance of the port there. I think one of the reasons why we've seen this nosedive in international freight rates from Shanghai to both Rotterdam in Europe, but also to LA in the US. I think it's driven by this easing of restrictions that we've seen in Shanghai from basically early September until now. But now they're starting to reverse course, basically. So I wouldn't consider this Chinese reopening story to be anything to celebrate, at least for now. But Weston, let's move back to a couple of the questions that we get in here. We get a lot of questions, and please keep them coming. We always love to interact with our audience. We have a question from Claudius. Yeah. Do you want to add something before I go ahead?
Well, I actually want to. I want to just cut the line of everyone and ask you a question regarding China. Sure. And this is something I asked Jin Biago on Twitter earlier. This is like, so I don't know. This is probably a stupid and oversimplified question, but what I wanted to ask you was, so is this a scenario, the following two scenarios, is this something that would make sense? Okay, so China shut down, right? That would lead to supply chain disruptions and shortages, and that would become inflationary. And then China reopen would result in the world's second largest, consumer market, which had been largely absent throughout this entire, global inflation surge that we're experiencing. And so a reopen would also be inflationary. So both scenarios would kind of have an inflationary outcome. Is that a way to think about it, or?
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense to me, but I think you need to look at it from the perspective of Chinese imports relative to exports. So the stuff that China imports on a net basis will prove to be inflationary in a scenario like the one you described, while the stuff that China export on a net basis will prove to be globally disinflationary in such an environment. So I think on a net basis, goods will drop in price, but I think energy will increase, and in particular, industrial metals will increase in price as a consequence of a reopening. So we have a bit of both pros and cons when it comes to inflation during a Chinese reopening. And I mean, frankly speaking, I don't think from an inflation perspective, it's necessarily something to salute if China reopens. When I don my tinfoil hat, I also think it's part of the reason why they've dragged along so long time with this zero COVID policy. It is a way to keep the economy at bay at a time needed, because she knows that a runaway inflation is not a scenario that you would like as a dictator. Let me put it like that. Let's get to a couple of questions. And I wanted to pass on the greetings to you for the Japanese win over Germany. A couple of people have asked me to pass on those greetings. But anyway, we have a great question from Claudius. So he's asking what he considers to be a very basic question. I think it's a super complicated question, but let's see what your take is. Are the moves in the dollar impacting short-term bond yields, or is it the other way around? Or does it go both ways? So when we watch the price action in interest rates, does it spill over to the dollar, or is it the other way around? Is it possible to answer that question?
I believe it is. Thank you for bringing that up. So Brian, can you pull up chart one, please? This just happens to be a set of charts that I have prepared. But basically what we're looking at is, all right, when you hear people saying like late October was or wasn't the top in U.S. yields, right? Now, I'm not going to argue as to whether it was or wasn't. It may very well be or not be. I'm just wondering if these people realize that and are factoring in what actually triggered this reversal, the actual market flow, and why, when they're making these calls, and if they're factoring in the yen. Now, if you look at this, basically that's the 21st, that's the top, right? If you go to chart two, that move was essentially driven by a massive, massive yen futures short covering. So that's nearly about 600,000 yen futures contracts that traded. That's about a little under 50 billion notional that traded that day. That's the most on record, and more than half of which traded within 2 hours, within like around that 10:30 a.m. Eastern time. That's when this all kind of kicked off. There was no similar, unusually large U.S. Treasury futures volume or activity at that whipsaw moment. This was yen driven. Chart three, if you look at the next one, you'll see that this is just CFTC's commitment of traders positioning for levered funds. And since that week, which is, they go weekly, so that's the 25th, but levered funds, hedge funds essentially, that have been basically piled into this short yen trade for a number of reasons, one of which is because it's a Fed trade, right? It's a policy divergent trade. That the short yen positioning fell, or trade exiting, by about 20,000 contracts. So this is a short squeeze that's underway, right? Short covering begets short covering, and that pulls USD JPY down and down below through like the 140 handle now, from 150 plus prior. And then, so what the hell was with that moment at the on the 21st of October at 10:30 a.m.? Last chart, Brian, on number chart 4. Supposedly, that was when the Ministry of Finance of Japan had intervened, or at least the Nikkei, the media company, reporting about that. Okay, so was that the top in U.S. yields? Maybe, maybe not. But I just want to point out that what kicked that off in the first place? It was this massive yen short covering, apparently because of Ministry of Finance officials, like the Japan officials, meddling in foreign exchange markets, or at least reported to do so, that put that top in. So this is all stuff to keep in mind when you're looking at yields and whether or not, like, you're kind of thinking about, was that the top or not? Make sure you're factoring at least that part in, or at least that you're aware of what's happening with this, because the short yen trade is the most crowded trade in global macro, was in 2022. And if that's going to start becoming like unwound and there's a short covering that's going to be underway, you can very well see a rally in US treasuries, or a pull down in further pull down in the long end of the US treasury curve, and as well as dollar yen to fall and all that. And it's not necessarily going to, you know, be like in a straight line or anything like that. But I mean, there is still a lot of positioning that needs to be exited if that trade is going to be unwound. So there's your answer.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Interesting takeaways and a very great answer to the question from Claudius. We have a related question from Steve. He's asking for the impact of a lower dollar on the US inflation and whether a weakening dollar will keep inflation propped up in the US even after the housing component rolls over in the CPI into next year. I have my take on that, and then I'll allow you to chip in as well, Weston. Seen from European soil, I would not consider the exchange rate of the US dollar as important for US inflation as the exchange rate of other currencies is for inflation elsewhere. The reason is that the US is what I call an 80/20 economy, so 80% domestically based, very domestically propped up by domestic demand. And therefore, the import price is of less relevance to the printed inflation month after month relative to export-oriented, very open economies with a demand that is more based on export demand in other economies outside of the home borders. And therefore, watching price action in the US dollar right now, let's assume that we get a 10% drop in the US dollar. It's not necessarily something that will alter the picture a whole lot for CPI into next year. It's obviously net a positive for inflation, so bringing inflation higher. But I would suspect that a 10% move in the US dollar will only contribute with less than 0.5 percentage points to the overall CPI basket. That's sort of my gut feeling. We can obviously have a deeper look at the numbers and bring a clearer picture on the exact effect. But again, an 80-20 economy, so only 20% of the economy is truly impacted, I'd say, directly from exchange rates. Any views on that, and sort of potentially also the side effects in Japan and how inflation works there?
Yeah, just to add to that, I think that you're totally spot on, right? And I'm just going to trust your math. What I'll add to that, though, is I think that what the question is asking isn't necessarily about inflation per se. I think that it's in the context of FOMC and rate hikes and things like that. And if that is the case, then although it might not have that much of an impact, if any, domestically within the U.S., it will have an impact, a weaker dollar on financial conditions, which is basically the U.S. dollar. It's, it's the equity markets, it's credit spreads and so on and so forth. So that's a component of it. And so if the dollar is going to weaken financial conditions at a time where, the Fed is, as we saw in the minutes, still on a hiking path, even if it's going to be 50 basis points or whatever it is, that's still a lot. That's not going to help that. So in that context, it's something to the weaker dollar is something to keep in mind for domestic policy.
We have time for a final question, and it's related to the yield curve and the curvature of the dollar yield curve. So the question is, Wes, I don't know whether that's your new nickname, but what does the U.S. bond curve, does the U.S. bond curve being so solidly inverted, and what does it tell you right now with even the, for example, 1 month to 10-year spread being upside down?
I mean, the inversion is pretty insane, but at least for the front end, it's really not like that out of line with Fed policy, if I'm not really mistaken, right? So, I guess it's signaling that we're going to have this inevitable recession. I mean, there's nothing really I could add of any value here other than to say that it doesn't seem completely, out of place per se or detached from reality with regards to front end policy. And if you're looking at what the 3 month 30 or the 2s 10s or whatever it is, like the longer end too, I mean, again, like it is a very extreme inversion, but it does seem to make sense within the context of each of those sort of each duration and what drives that fundamentally on both ends.
I tend to agree, Weston. And one thing that I can add on this discussion on the very inverted yield curve, we are basically approaching minus 100 basis points in the spread between 2-year and 10-year bond yields in OIS terms, so in overnight index swap terms, is that I don't think we have more than a couple of historical comparisons since the Middle Ages when it comes to a yield curve that is as inverted as right now. And what I can say is that what happened after those yield curve inversions, the latest being in the 70s, was that we had, first of all, ultimately a double top in inflation. That was what happened afterwards. So a slide in inflation, but then afterwards a new top in inflation. Probably due to central banks easing too fast, fiscal authorities pushing too much with the easing agenda as well. And then secondly, we had if not an industrial revolution, then at least an industrial outperformance in equity space. So after this massive yield curve inversion of the 70s, we had sort of an explosion of investments in the industrial space. So in that case, it seems kind of similar equity-wise to 2001, 2002, where industrials outperformed, for example, technology by a mile over the subsequent 2 to 3 years after such an inversion. Whether the analogy makes any sense in today's environment is a bit debatable. But in any case, I tend to think that this is a warning signal that this is not the kind of financial environment that we've been living in for the past 20 years. Weston, we've now been live for 32 minutes, so I wanted to ask you whether you have any sort of final remarks for the audience while we check whether any final questions have come in.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you reminded me of this Japan upset, there may be a correlation because you have Japan against Germany, that in the World Cup upset, and then you have the Saudis winning. And so there may be a correlation between like countries with a heavy exposure to SoftBank and like upset wins in the World Cup. But I'll have to look into that further. And that's my final thought.
Short SoftBank, long Japan and Saudi Arabia in the World Cup, and then you have the perfect head, sure.
So the next match, whatever it is, if you're the underdog, just see if your country or that country has any exposure to SoftBank, and if it does, bet on it.
Very good advice to end today's Real Vision Daily Briefing with. And Brian, please bring up today's meme, because I wanted to wish all of you a very nice Thanksgiving weekend. I will leave you with this meme of the day. Turkey is stuffed, but it's not Thanksgiving yet. Turkey is the best performer this year in equity space. I think that's a mind-blowing fact, and it's 50 percentage points better performing than number two. I will leave it at that for the Real Vision Daily Briefing today. My name is Andreas Steno. Thank you for watching out there. We will be back on Monday after the long weekend.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.